Good morning, everyone, and welcome to a series on Megillat Rut. For the next 4 weeks, even though there are lots of things to talk about excitingly with the Parasha, it's an opportunity to talk about Megillat Rut, if I'm being honest. Now, quite a while ago, I bought a 2-inch thick sefer on Megillat Rut, and I've never really read enough of it. And so by spending 1 week on each of the parakim, each of the chapters of Megillat Rut, it gives me an opportunity to read through the sefer and share some of the really interesting ideas. It is a book by Yael Ziegler entitled Ruth. So it's a really, really fantastic book. And so as we're going to talk about today, the very first chapter, though in truth, we're going to talk about the very, just the first five verses as we are now. Shifting to a hybrid model of both in-person and Zoom. If you look in the chat, and I'm gonna type it in again. If you look in the chat, you should get a link to Sfaria. Should have just come up, and you can click on that link, and that will take you to the source sheet. Anyone listening to the recording, the link is already posted on YU Torah, but hopefully everyone is able to follow along with the source sheet that is in front of them. Again, if you do have technical issues, let me know and we can try and solve it for next time. But what you'll see straight away is the very first source is the opening five verses to Megillat Rut. These are fascinating verses, and we're going to be focusing specifically on the character of Elimelech, but first we'll just read these verses. So Megillat Rut begins, Vayhi b'nei shvot ha-shoftim. It was in the time when the judges, the chieftains, ruled. Vayhi ra'av ba'aretz. There was a famine in the land. Vayelech ish mi beit lechem Yehuda, lagor b'stei Moav. A man from Beit Lechem, from Bethlehem of the tribe of Yehuda, he went to live in Moav. Hu v'ishto u'shnei vanav, him, his wife, and his two sons. And now we learn Vashem Ha'ish Elimelech, his name was Elimelech. Vashem Ishton Naomi, Vashem Shnevanav, Machon, Vichilion Ephratim, Yibet Lechem Yudah, Vayavosh, Temoah, Vayhusham. We get their names. Fine. Then we read Vayamot, verse 3, Vayamot Elimelech Ish Naomi, Elimelech died. Leaving behind his wife and two children. Those two children marry Moabite women, Orpah and Rut. And then those two sons also die. So now Naomi, Orpah and Rut are kind of left alone trying to figure things out themselves. This is obviously setting the plot, setting the scene for the story. Now, when we look at this story on a pshat level, literal reading, nothing here is to suggest that anything wrong has happened on behalf of Elimelech, on behalf of Machlon, on behalf of Kilion. It could very well be that the time gap between verses 2 and 3 is many decades. It could be that we have this man, Elimelech, who left to move to Moab with his family, and they lived there for a great, you know, again, exactly how, you know, the timing would work based on marriageable age and all the rest. But the point could be, Elimelech could have been old, they moved to Moab, and then, you know, he lives to the end of his days, and he passes away, and yada, yada, yada. Okay, Machlon and Kilion's deaths seem slightly more tragic, but Elimelech's death isn't necessarily obviously tragic, or it isn't necessarily obviously sudden. And yet our temptation as readers, and the way traditionally these opening verses are understood, is that they are teaching us that Elimelech died for a reason, that there is something about his moving to Stay Moav, his moving to the country of Moab, that causes his death. And so one example of this, if you take a look on the source sheet, you should now see a Gemara from Bava Batra should be the second source on the sheet, which states, V'chein haya Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai Omer, Elimelech, so an explanation as to why they died, Elimelech, Machlon, V'chilion, G'dolei Hador Hayu. They were the prominent members of their generation. They were the leaders of their generation. Ufarnasei Hador, and they were the leaders. Umipnei ma ne'enshu. Why were they punished? Mipnei sheyatzu umei eretz luchutza la'aretz, because they left the land of Israel. Says Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai in the Gemara in Bava Batra, the reason Elimelech died was because he left the land of Israel. Now, I will remember, and for people just joining, please click in the chat for a link to the source sheet, but which is hopefully still there and hopefully remains there, even if you sign on at a later point. But if not, just chat that you don't actually see the source sheet in there, and then I'll paste it back again. Why did Elimelech die? Because he left the land of Israel. I actually remember when I was in yeshiva in Israel, I was in yeshivat HaKotel, which is very much a very, very hardcore Zionistic yeshiva, on Shavuot, going to one of the rabbi's houses. And he was, you know, we're all sat around his table, and he wants to, you know, learn with his like 5-year-old son at the time. It's very cute. He puts him on his lap. And he's like, so, you know, kid, why did Elimelech die? Because they left the land of Israel. And then looks at all of us, we who are all about to leave the land of Israel to go back to our respective homes. And everyone at the time was like, whoa, this is a little bit intense now. But says the Gemara in Bava Batra, that was the reason. Okay, it's a well-known reason, but we are going to look for a slightly different answer as to why Elimelech is viewed so critically, why we assume that there is something to do with his death that is sudden and is in some way a punishment. So to focus once again on this Gemara in Bava Batra, where do we get the idea that Elimelech is the leader of his generation? So there's a really cool suggestion as to why this might be the case. So if you once again look at the very first source, the opening verse to Megillat Rut, it says, "Vayhi bimei shvot hashoftim." It was in the days when the judges judged. Now, there is a well-known idea whenever, it's a midrashic idea, whenever one encounters the word vayhi, bad things are about to happen. But what's interesting is these two words, vayhi bimei, occur 5 times in Tanakh. And the other 4 instances, I put on the source sheet. And notice something. The very first time the two words vayhi bimei occur is in chapter 14 of Sefer Bereshit, the very first verse, which says, "Vayhi bimei Amraphel Melech Shinar." It was in the days of King Amraphel of Shinar, Eryach Melech Elasar, Kedar Laomer Melech Elam, Vitidal Melech Goyim. It was in the days of these kings. The next time it occurs is Sefer Yeshayahu, the book of Isaiah. The opening verse to chapter 7 says, "Vayhi bimei Achaz ben Yotam ben Uzziah Melech Yehuda." It was during the reign of Achaz, the king of Yehuda, that so-and-so happened. The next time it occurs is Sefer Yirmiyahu, the 3rd verse of the 1st chapter of Sefer Yirmiyahu. "Vayhi bimei Yehoyakim ben Yoshiyahu melech Yehuda." It was in the days of Yoshiyahu, the king of Yehuda. And finally, and perhaps the most well-known, because we only read it a couple of months ago, "Vayhi bimei Achashverosh." It was in the times of Achashverosh, the opening verse to Esther. "Hu Achashverosh hamolech melech Yehuda Kush." This was the very Achashverosh who ruled from Hodu to Kush. The other 4 times we encounter Vayhi bimei, it is to introduce us to a king. It is to introduce us to the name of a ruler. And so when we start reading Shoftim, and again, we always have to assume, Tanakh assumes you are well-versed in Tanakh. The way it is kind of literarily crafted, it is expecting a certain sense of connectivity between verses that resonate. When we read Vayhi bimei shvot hashoftim, it should instantly conjure, we are about to be introduced to a king. This kind of makes sense also when you think about the whole point, the whole failing central to the book of Shoftim is that there is no king. And I actually realized another cool point to point out here is, in a sense, Megillat Rut does introduce us to a king. The very last verse is going to introduce that David was the progeny of Rut. But right now we are expecting to be introduced to a king. And we learn that there is a man, Vayelech Ish mi Beit Lechem Yehuda. That this man, so first of all, we get Vayhi bimei, so we think we're about to be introduced to a king. And then we learn that there is a man from Beit Lechem and Yehuda. Now, even though in the times of Shoftim itself, these locations didn't have particular resonance to a reader of Tanakh, Yehuda, Beit Lechem. This is Davidic imagery. So again, part of that is because Megillat Ruth heavily leans into Davidic imagery because, you know, this is the origin story of David HaMelech, or at least his ancestors. But again, everything in this first verse screams royal imagery, leadership imagery. And so it's a somewhat obvious conclusion, or at least it's not much of a stretch to argue that Elimelech is being set up as a leader of his generation. And so everything about Elimelech should point to a positive figure, someone we would look at positively. Similarly, his actual name, we tend not to focus enough on the names biblical characters are given, but Elimelech means, you know, Eli, my God. Melech is king. That is a really from name, particularly in the times of Shoftim, where there was no king. The idea that someone would be given the name, you know, my God is king, points to a religious fealty, a religious commitment, something, again, it tells you a lot about his family. It tells you that is an impressive name for someone to be given. Eli Melech actually also has a lot of parallels in the ancient Near East. It was a popular name, but it refers to the idea, the acceptance that the true king, the one king, is God. And yet Chazal in a midrash, again on the source sheet, from Rut Rabbah, the 2:5, Chazal understand this slightly differently. V'shem ha'ish Eli Melech, Shahaya Omer, Eli Tavo Malchut. To me will come kingship. So this is classic midrash, taking advantage of the fact that Hebrew is never written with its vowels. It's never actually vocalized. So a classic tool you do if you're a member of Chazal is you creatively, intentionally reread a word a different way that's also still plausible based on alternative vowels. And so Elimelech, Aleph Lamed Yud, could be read, the way it's being read is Elimelech, my God is king. But you could also read Aleph Lamed Yud as Eli Melech. And again, this is setting up the idea that Elimelech was not actually a leader of his generation, but someone who sought leadership, someone who craved responsibility, but wasn't necessarily a positive figure in his own right. So we are set up, we begin Megillat Rut, the opening verses give us, on the one hand, the imagery of a figure who is very much a leader of his people, woven into the royal imagery, the imagery of David. We set up this idea that Elimelech is a good guy. Eli Melech, my God is king. He's a religious role model. He has a religious name, and he's connected to all this royal imagery and royal words. And yet, Chazal seem desperate to paint him as a negative figure. And there seems to be this desire to connect his death to punishment. So what is going on here? What is it? What great sin did Elimelech commit that causes him to be seen as a figure of not to be seen positively, other than leaving the land of Israel? So if you take a look at the next source, which is again from Rut Rabbah, which asks, Lama ne'enash Elimelech? Why was Elimelech punished? Kach Elimelech haya migdolei hamadina umafarnasei hador. So once again, it states he was one of the leaders of his generation. He was one of the, you know, he was among the most important people. Uchshaba'u shnei ra'avon. When the years of famine arrived, Amar, he said, Achshav kol Yisrael mesabavin pitchi. Now all the Jewish people are going to come knocking on my door because I'm wealthy, I'm a leader, I have means. Everyone's going to want charity. Ze bekupato, veze bekupato, this one with that basket, this one with that basket. Everyone's going to be asking for food. Amad uvarach lo mipnehem, he therefore got up and fled from them. Hadahu dichtiv, vayelech ish mi beit lechem yudan. This is why it says a man of beit lechem yudan. Say chazal, that this figure, all the imagery points to the fact that he is a leader of his generation. And yet, during famine, vayhi ra'av ba'aretz, we are informed, vayhi b'mei shvot ha-shoftim, the opening verse, it was in the days of when the judges judged, there was a famine, and a man from Beit Lechem went to Moab. And say chazal, this man, Elimelech, has all the trappings of positive leadership, and yet we must understand that the famine prompted him to move. Now, and that revealed his selfishness, his lack of kindness, his lack of chesed to his fellow Jews in refusing to support them. Now, that being said, you could make the argument that, sure, you know, leaders, wealthy people should attempt to support those with less. But is he really deserving of divine fury, divine wrath, and our disregard for leaving during the famine? Sure, a wealthy person who stays to help people, we get it. We're going to celebrate them. But someone who leaves, are we really going to judge them? To use a modern day analogy that I think really actually hits this home, we would admire anyone who stays in Ukraine to help the fight. But if someone leaves, are we going to turn to that person and be like, you could have helped? No, I don't think any of us can honestly turn around and criticize Elimelech for fleeing during a famine. It's still a famine. Sure, people could have relied on him. But it's still a fact. So is it really right to criticize Elimelech so strongly for leaving during a famine, which is a situation I think many of us would contemplate doing if we found ourselves in a similar situation? Even if we occupied positions of leadership, positions of wealth, we might still get out if we could. And this is where the location that Elimelech turns to becomes important. Because the truth is, we have models already in Tanakh, the most positive figures you could imagine, who do leave the land of Israel during a famine. Literally the second or third thing we learn about Avraham Avinu is that he encounters a famine, verse 10 of chapter 12 of Sefer Bereshit on the source sheet. Vayhi ra'av ba'aretz, there was a famine in the land. Avraham just literally arrives in the land of Israel, and it turns out there's a famine. Vayered Avram Mitzrayma lagor sham, Avram descends to go dwell in Egypt, ki choved hara'av ba'aretz, because the famine was severe in the land. Now, famously, Ramban, Nachmanides, actually criticizes Avraham for this. He thinks it reveals Avraham's lack of faith. He should have trusted that God would provide for him. And because Avraham descended to Egypt then because of a famine, Avraham's future descendants were punished by slavery. And it's actually very cool when you look at, if you compare the verses between Avraham's descent to Egypt, that there are a surprisingly large number of parallels between the experience of the Jews in Egypt and Avraham's descent to Egypt because of the famine. But broadly speaking, no one else thinks Avraham does anything wrong here. Everyone thinks Avraham did the sensible thing. Avraham faces a famine. Famines in the land of Israel, again, this is maybe obvious, but it requires underscoring. You know, in an agricultural world where you subsist off the produce of your land, and the land of Israel is not the most fertile and glorious of places. It's not necessarily easy. Its climate isn't good. So famine is, thank God, we don't really understand nowadays the notion of famine. We thank God are able to, and that's something we shouldn't take for granted living in 21st century America. But you know, famine was the kind of thing of course you would flee from. And so Avraham flees to Egypt. Similarly, Yaakov Avinu, Jacob, also leaves the land of Egypt because of the famine. It's not so tightly woven into just one verse, like the example with Abraham. But if we remember the story of Yosef and the story of Yaakov, there is a famine, and that's what prompts, you know, the whole sending his children down. They meet with Yosef, and it culminates in verse 6 of chapter 46 of Sefer Bereishit on the source sheet. You know, Vaykhu et miknehem ve'ed ruchusham asher rachshu be'eretz Kana'an. They take everything they had amassed in Kana'an. Vayavo mitzrayma. Yaakov v'chol zara ito. Yaakov and all of his family, they all go with him down to Egypt. So we have two, about as positive a biblical model as you can find, Abraham and Yaakov, both descending to Egypt to avoid a famine. Yitzchak doesn't, but that's because Yitzchak is commanded explicitly to never leave the land of Israel. But Avraham and Yaakov both comfortably go down to Egypt. And admittedly, in the case of Yaakov, it doesn't end well. But there's no hint of an actual judgment on Yaakov's decision here. The opposite. It's a good decision to move his family down to Egypt. God even tells him, you are doing the right thing. Keep it up. And so how can it be that with Elimelech, who is I get it. He's a leader of his generation. Maybe he could have supported people. He has wealth. But are we really going to criticize him for something that Avraham and Yaakov themselves, who, quite frankly, if you actually just look at, again, the verse 6 of chapter 46, they have livestock, they have wealth. Yaakov has means. Clearly, he doesn't have, even though, again, when you think about it, he does have the ability to purchase grain because that's what he sent his kids down to do. But nonetheless, he decides to move down to be with Yosef. And maybe it's not explicitly to leave the famine, to flee the famine per se, but it's pretty clear that's one of the motivating factors. And so how can it be that we are criticizing Elimelech for leaving the land of Israel because of a famine versus withholding judgment from Avraham and Yaakov? So one answer still might be responsibility. I get that. I'm not going to necessarily dispute that. But there's an even more interesting reason why we would criticize Elimelech and not Avraham and Yaakov. And that's the place they moved to. Avraham and Yaakov moved to Egypt, a vast country that to a certain extent, though I am not an expert on geography, Egypt has enough of a different ecosystem that what it is going through isn't going to be the same as the land of Israel. If Israel is experiencing a famine, that doesn't necessarily mean that Egypt is experiencing a famine, because chances are what's going to prompt Israel's famine is going to be rain related. And even though Egypt is reliant on rain, Egypt has famously a giant body of water running through it, which basically every single city in Egypt throughout human history, which has been a long, 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 long time, has always lived on the banks of the Nile, even though nowadays Egypt is actually trying to build cities further away to try and decongest its major cities. But that's a completely different topic. But I just watched a cool YouTube video about it a few weeks ago. But Avraham and Yaakov move to a place where the agricultural reality is different. That is not the case for Elimelech. Moab is different to Israel, but not in the same way Egypt is. If Israel is going through a famine, there is a, you know, non-trivial likelihood that Moab is also going through a famine. Why then? If it is the equivalent of, I mean, it's the equivalent of escaping Ukraine to the US, to the UK makes sense. But if someone escaped Ukraine to another war-torn location, why on earth are they doing it? And this is what I think causes Chazal to have such a strident critique of Elimelech. Because to go to the land of Moab is to make a clear decision about the kinds of people you want to live with. We read, and it's the final source on the sheet, Sefer Devarim, a fascinating rule. Lo yavo amoni u'moavi b'kal Hashem. No descendant of Ammon and Moab is allowed to join the Jewish people. Gam Dor Asiri, even to the 10th generation, Lo Yavol Lahem B'Kal Hashem Ad Olam. They can never, ever, ever join the Jewish people. So this is, you know, there are some nations where God did not allow the initial generations to join the Jewish people, but after a while, the status no longer applied. Ammon and Moab are forbidden always from joining the Jewish people. And the reason that I think is kind of the obvious reason is because there must be some, it's more than a national stereotype. There is a culture, there is a tribal ethic that is so counterintuitive to the Torah that God forbids these people, because these people will never be able to join the Jewish people. Such is their ethic, is so fundamentally different than that of the Jewish people, that they will never be allowed to be admitted into Kahal Hashem. What is this ethic? What is this deficiency in Moabites that makes them unable to ever become part of the Jewish people? And yes, by the way, just to preempt the question, Megillat Rut is all about a Moabite woman marrying into the Jewish people and being ultimately the ancestor of David HaMelech, to which, you know, practically we assume it really applies to men, not women. But what is the failing trait of Moab? We are told, and it's recounting an episode that happens earlier in the Torah, verse 5 of chapter 23 of Sefer Devarim, Al Devar asher lo kidmu etchem bolechem uvamayim, because they did not meet you with bread, with water, baderech betzeitchem yimitzrayim, when you left Egypt, va'asher sachar alech et Bil'am ben Be'or mitpor aram naharayim likal alecha, and because they also hired Bil'am. But what seems to be the chief reason is that the Moabites were not Ba'alei Chesed. They were not kind. They didn't give to the Jewish people in that time of need. It's also important to note, we are related to Moabites. Moab and Ammon are descended from Lot, the brother of Abraham. And so there is supposed to be an assumed tribal affinity between Moab and the Jewish people. That is an important point just to make on these verses here, is it's not like a random tribe who have no connection whatsoever to the Jewish people. There is, even distant, but there is supposed to be a fraternal bond between Moab, Ammon, and the Jewish people. And yet they didn't, lo kidmu etchem b'lechem uvamayim, they didn't help you with bread and water. Why can the Ammonites and Moabites never join the Jewish people? Because we assume, and this parallels very much the famous ideas of the failings of Sodom and its associated towns, that they refused to help. And a refusal to help was actually a trait they saw as positive. That, no, we don't have a responsibility to help others. We don't help those in need. They need to do it all themselves. That is considered to be the defining positive trait of Moab, to the point that this person can never become a Jew because they don't understand what it is to be a Baal Chesed. Why does Elimelech move to Moab? So what Chazal are seeing here is the temptation to move to Moab would not have been to escape the famine, because there's a good likelihood Moab was going through the famine too. But if you move to a place where you don't have a responsibility to others, where no one expects you to have to give of yourself, that's what prompts Elimelech to move. It's his raw selfishness. What Moab is not a tempting location to move to if you're looking to escape a famine, but it is a really tempting location to move to if you're looking to not help others, if you're looking to avoid having to have a responsibility to those in need. And so when Elimelech moves to Moab because of the famine, it's teaching us that he's moving to a place not known for its agricultural stability, but known for its miserliness. And so we end up getting this portrait of Elimelech, which reveals a figure who is set up to be a leader, royal imagery, who is set up to be a religious model, Eli Melech, my God is king, but who turns out to exhibit far more Eli Malchut, a desire for responsibility, but not actually willing to act on it, who ends up moving to a morally dubious place who ends up moving to Moab in order to escape not the famine, but his responsibility to help others. And for that reason, we tend to read naturally Megillat Rut as implying a taint with Elimelech, as implying that this act of moving to Moab and then the fact that his death is recorded in just the very next verse implies that the two are connected, that he's being punished, not for leaving the land of Israel, not for even refusing to help those in need, but for being so unwilling to help those in need that he moves to the one place in the world that he will never actually have to help anyone. And obviously the major theme of Megillat Rut is going to be chesed, is going to be the kindness of others. Rut is often seen as the ultimate model of chesed, but also we are going to see Boaz, a figure who ends up, you know, marrying Rut, who, from whom David HaMelech comes from, who is going to be the complete opposite. He's going to be the ultimately generous figure within the story of Megillat Rut, but it is set up that Boaz will be an incredibly sharp contrast to Elimelech, the ultimate miser who fled a famine, not because he wanted to subsist, not even because he didn't want to bear the burden of having to help people, but because he just didn't want to ever have to help anyone. And for that reason, tradition preserves him as a tremendously negative figure.